Welcome to our Local Voices special presentation called A Glance Back on 94.7 KPIP LP Fayette. A Glance Back is brought to you by the Boonslick Historical Society and its president, respected Fayette community member Jim Steele, journalist, graphic designer, and local historian. Local Voices, A Glance Back, a two-hour program, airs every Monday and Friday starting at noon and then again at 4 p.m. The show focuses on the music, radio features, and history of World War II and beyond as it affected Fayette, America, and the world. Thank you for tuning in to this special edition of Local Voices, only on 94.7 KPIP.
Would you like to swing on a star, carry moonbeams home in a jar, and be better off than you are? Or would you rather be a mule? A mule is an animal with long, funny ears, kicks up at anything he hears.
His back is brawny, but his brain is weak. He's just plain stupid with a stubborn streak.
And by the way, if you hate to go to school, you may grow up to be a mule.
Or would you like to swing on a star, carry moonbeams home in a jar, and be better off than you are?
Or would you rather be a pig?
A pig is an animal with dirt on his face. His shoes are a terrible disgrace. He has no manners when he eats his food. He's fat and lazy and extremely rude.
But if you don't care a feather or a fig, you may grow up to be a pig.
Or would you like to swing on a star, carry moonbeams home in a jar, and be better off than you are?
Or would you rather be a fish?
A fish won't do anything but swim in a brook. He can't write his name or read a book. To fool the people is his only thought. And though he's slippery, he still gets caught.
But then if that sort of life is what you wish, you may grow up to be a fish. Kind of jumped up slippery fish, and all the monkeys aren't in the zoo.
Every day you meet quite a few,
so you see it's all up to you. You can be better than you are. You could be swinging on a star.
Enjoy the good old days when the world came together to fight for the good of all. This is Local Voices with historian Jim Steele on 94.7 KPIP.
Trumpet man from all Chicago way. He had a boogie style that no one else could play. He was the top man at his craft. But then his number came up and he was gone with the draft. He's in the army now, a blowing reveille. He's the boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B. They made him blow a bugle for his Uncle Sam. It really brought him down because he couldn't jam. The captain seemed to understand, because the next day the cap went out and drafted a band. And now the company jumps when he plays reveille. He's the boogie-woogie bugle boy of Company B. A toot, a toot, a toot de la da toot. He blows it eight to the bar. In boogie rhythm, he can't blow a note unless the bass and guitar is playing with him. He makes a company jump when he plays reveille. He's the boogie-woogie bugle boy of Company B. He was a boogie-woogie bugle boy of Company B. Boogie bugle, he was busy as a buzz bee. And when he plays, he makes the company jump a to the bar. He's a boogie boogie bugle boy of Company B. Toot 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 da da toot da da toot toot. He blows it a to the bar. He can't blow a note if the bass and guitar isn't with him. And the company jumps when he plays reveille. He's a boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B. With boogie every night and wakes them up the same way in the early bright. They clap their hands and stamp their feet because they know how he plays when someone gives him a beat. He really breaks it up when he plays reveille. He's the boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B.
When he plays reveille, he's the boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B. Blue moon, you saw me standing alone without a dream in my heart, without a love of my own. Blue moon, you knew just what I was there for. You heard me saying a prayer for someone I really could care for. And then there suddenly appeared before me the only one my arms will ever hold. I heard somebody whisper, please adore me. And when I looked, the moon had turned to gold. Blue moon, now I'm no longer alone. without a dream in my heart, without a love of my own. Whispered, please adore me. And I looked, the moon had turned to gold. Blue moon, now I'm no longer alone. Without a dream in my heart, without a love of my own.
You are listening to Local Voices on 94.7 KPIP. Now, our local historian Jim Steele will take us back to the age of World War II.
Today on KPIP Local Voices, a glance back, we continue with part three of our mid-1930s summation of bringing REA, electrical power, to the rural residents of Howard County. In early 1937, leaders of the recently formed cooperative, as we noted last week, met again in the courthouse and signed the REA loan papers with the ultimate goal of bringing modern living to the farms. So the project now was off and running. Meanwhile, Fayette's power plant was gearing up to supply the load. At its plant just off the city's downtown, a fourth diesel engine powered generator was in the works. Workers used 700 sacks of cement to pour the footings for the monster engine, scheduled to be installed by the Fairbanks Morse Company in March of 37. Well, by July, enough progress had been made that the directors of the co-op were ready to let bids for line construction. They picked a Kansas City construction firm to do the work. A story in the Democrat Leader stated, directors of the Howard Electric Cooperative Association have signed a contract with the Cater Construction Company to build about 130 miles of rural power line to serve farmers of this county. The contract was led on a unit bid of $102,000. A loan of $130,000 had been secured from the REA by the county association. Now, the story in the paper went on to report that staking of the first line had almost been completed and construction was to begin at once. It was also noted that the project was expected to be completed by early October of that year, and farmers being served by the line would have electricity by the middle of October. That unfortunately didn't happen. The line shown on a map of Howard County looked like a giant octopus covering all sections of the county with its tentacles. Arms stretched out from Fayette in all directions, bringing electric power to farmers along the routes from Fayette to the Burton vicinity, also to the county farm, Montauk Chapel, Drake School neighborhood, New Franklin, Richland, Pleasant Green Church, the Triangle Filling Station, Boonesboro, Petersburg, and so forth. Covering most sections of the county with trunk lines from which spurs would be constructed later. The board received 11 bids. These ranged from a high of just over $132,000 to the Cater Company's low of about $102,000. Now, to encourage farmers to sign up right away, County Agent Dan Miller, you may recall, had spearheaded this project, told the farmers they could save considerable money by signing up immediately. He went on to note that if they signed up before the line is constructed, a pole with transformers will be placed in front of their farms, and they thus would escape the extra installation charge. Another meeting of the local REA board was held on July 30th of 37. At that meeting, an REA rep from Washington met with the board and also electric dealers to explain specifications for the installation of wiring and other equipment. By August of 1937, the contractor is ready to start setting poles. Four railroad boxcar loads of materials were delivered to Fayette, and these were stored at the Farmers Co-op building where the construction company had set up its office. Now all that was needed was the final go-ahead from REA. However, before work could start, a new twist was added to the workload. An ambitious group of Randolph County residents asked to be included. That must have been welcome news to the Howard County group, which still was struggling to convince reluctant members to sign up. The Democrat leader then reported that last-minute changes were being made to include 30 miles of line going in Randolph County. The projected line toward Burton would make a three-phase line. 15 miles was to be added to carry current to Randolph, to the Randolph-Howard County border, and 30 miles of line in Randolph County would be serviced from Fayette. Consolidation with the Howard County project was negotiated as the easiest method of obtaining current for that section of the neighboring county. Spurs running east from Fayette would be the first ready for work. A substation had to be built on the lot owned by the city just south of the municipal power plant. Well, a delay in getting poles also slowed down construction at first. Despite the shortage, workers cleared right away and set anchors as the work progressed. At the height of construction, some 150 men worked on the new power line. These must have been welcome jobs in those days of high unemployment. Well, it took some creative skills to get that first line built. Early contractors had to learn to cut corners, avoided unnecessary guy lines and offsets in the line. This was recalled in a 1960 article in the Rural Electric Missourian, noting that the association could not afford to follow the roads. Leaders were proud of how the co-op made the most of every dollar, but the shortest distance between two points, that mentality caused later problems. Workers would run straight across a pasture rather than follow the roads, and later had to make a deal with making repairs in places they couldn't get to with a truck. Reports note that those early electrical engineers were breaking new ground and had little time to worry about the problems of future linemen. Many thought that the job could not be done at all, and it wouldn't have been done if it hadn't been for new engineering standards that had been drafted by the REA. Besides lending money to the cooperatives, REA also designed specifications that saved the rural co-ops money. For example, instead of using expensive electric cross arms, electric co-ops put the lines directly on the pole, one above the other. Materials were standardized between cooperatives so that suppliers could take advantage of economics of scale. To stretch the meager loan money even further, co-op manager Thomas Biswell headed to the field, dug holes for poles himself. His wife worked in the office and kept the books at no charge. Many months when bills were pressing, Biswell did not even get his pay of $100 a month. Directors served for a symbolic per diem of $150 at their monthly meetings. Members pitched in as well. They dug holes, cut trees, even stretched line. Astute businessmen in Fayette took a keen interest in the project, and they often followed the crews down the road, ready to sell appliances to the lucky housewife who was about to get electricity for the first time. Early meetings of the cooperative board had been held in the courthouse in Fayette. However, in October of 37, the co-op set up headquarters on the second floor of the Commercial Trust Building on the Carthouse Square. These tight quarters would become its home for 19 years. Now, the first actual test of the system was made in February 1938. Current was applied to all the lines except the Petersburg Circuit and the Burton Line. These later were still under construction, but soon would be completed and ready for service. With the test providing satisfactory, manager Biswell asked the REA to release the lines for service. He reports that approximately 140 meter bases were now in place. This meant that many farms had been wired or were in the process of being wired. But that was only about half the number required by a previous order from the REA, which stated that no lines would be released for service until an average of two houses per mile were hooked up and ready to receive electricity. This was the first sign of trouble for the new cooperative, struggling to be born into a hostile environment. Nonetheless, by March of 1938, the first line was virtually complete, with 124 miles constructed, 152 meters set, and 210 paid members. Rates were set, and were only slightly higher than rates being paid in Fayette, in spite of the lower, much lower population density out in the country. Stroke lines were energized on May the 18th, 1938, and crews immediately began fusing the transformers, the last operation standing between farmers and their dream of having electricity for the first time. Power came on to farm homes 2 days later. It must be kept in mind that this 1938 milestone included only a relatively small part of the county located near the original main line. Other sections got wired in as was possible to do, in some cases not until the late 1940s, early 1950s. Nonetheless, between May 1938 and 1945, co-op membership grew from 161 to 403 members. That is by no means the end of the story. Next week, I'll tell the entire account of how Howard County ultimately was fully electrified in spite of the Depression, World War II, and political maneuvering. For KPIP Local Voices, A Glance Back, this is Jim Steele reporting.
That was our Glance Back in Time with Jim Steele, president of the Boone Slick Historical Society. This series with Jim Steele will continue every Monday from noon to 4 p.m. during Local Voices, only on 94.7 KPIP.
In all the old familiar places that my heart and mind embraces all day through. In that small cafe, the park across the way, the children's carousel, the chestnut tree, the wishing well, I'll be seeing you in every lovely summer's day, in everything that's light and gay. I'll always think of you that way. I'll find you in the morning sun, and when the night is through, I'll be looking at the moon, but I'll be seeing you. Thank you.
taking a step back in time with Jim Steele on 94.7 KPIP.
I dreamt Uncle Sam was talking to the thunder of marching feet. And here's what he seemed to be saying to the soldier and the man on the street. Why are we working and fighting like we never did before? Oh, we wanna make sure, we're gonna make sure there'll never be another war. Why will we follow old glory where the flames and cannon roar? Oh, we wanna make sure, we're gonna make sure there'll never be another war. We're in line, we're all in line, and we're gonna keep our eye on the ball. You can bet we'll end the threat to life and liberty once and for all. When we've destroyed those destroyers, there'll be peace forevermore. Oh, we're gonna make sure, we're gonna make sure there'll never be another war. Listen, Americans, you've got the right to say the things you want to say, and you're entitled to it. You've got the right to pray the way you want to pray, and you're entitled to it. You've got the right to live beneath a peaceful sky above. You've got the right to work and play and sing and laugh and love, and you're entitled to it. But today, there are those who would take those rights away. Today, the world is threatened by human beasts of prey. Today, we've got to unite and fight to defend each precious right from the forces of destruction. Then all the downtrodden people will be free from fear once more, and we'll bury the sword with the help of the Lord. There'll never be another war.
This is 94.7 KPIP's Local Voices, A Glance Back. I'm Rachel, in for Jim Steele. On Sunday, May 2nd, 1943, FDR gave his 24th fireside chat. It was entitled, On the Coal Crisis. Speeches like these by Franklin Delano Roosevelt have come to be known as fireside chats. During these radio chats, the president would inform the American people and build public support for his administration's efforts during the Great Depression, World War II, and the enactment of New Deal policies. This is President Roosevelt's 24th fireside chat from Sunday, May 2nd, 1943, entitled On the Coal Crisis.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
My fellow Americans, I am speaking tonight to the American people, and in particular to those of our citizens who are coal miners. Tonight, this country faces a serious crisis. We are engaged in a war on the successful outcome of which will depend the whole future of our country. This war has reached a new critical phase. After the years that we have spent in preparation, we have moved into active and continuing battle with our enemies. We are pouring into the worldwide conflict everything that we have, our young men, and the vast resources of our nation. I have just returned from a 2 weeks tour of inspection on which I saw our men being trained and our war materials made. My trip took me through 20 states. I saw thousands of workers on the production line making airplanes and guns and ammunition. Everywhere I found great eagerness to get on with the war. Men and women are working long hours at difficult jobs and living under difficult conditions without complaint. Along thousands of miles of track, I saw countless acres of newly plowed fields. The farmers of this country are planting the crops that are needed to feed our armed forces, our civilian population, and our allies. Those crops will be harvested. On my trip, I saw hundreds of thousands of soldiers. Young men who were green recruits last autumn have matured into self-assured and hardened fighting men. They are in splendid physical condition. They are mastering the superior weapons that we are pouring out of our factories. The American people have accomplished a miracle. However, all of our massed effort is none too great to meet the demands of this war. We shall need everything that we have and everything that our allies have to defeat the Nazis and the fascists in the coming battles on the continent of Europe and the Japanese on the continent of Asia and in the islands of the Pacific. This tremendous forward movement of the United States and the United Nations cannot be stopped by our enemies. And equally, it must not be hampered by any one individual or by the leaders of any one group here back home. I want to make it clear that every American coal miner who has stopped mining coal, no matter how sincere his motives, no matter how legitimate he may believe his grievances to be, every idle miner, directly and individually, is obstructing our war effort. We have not yet won this war. We will win this war only as we produce and deliver our total American effort on the high seas and on the battle fronts. And that requires unrelenting, uninterrupted effort here on the home front. A stopping of the coal supply, even for a short time, would involve a gamble with the lives of American soldiers and sailors and the future security of our whole people. It would involve an unwarranted, unnecessary, and terribly dangerous gamble with our chances for victory. Therefore, I say to all miners and to all Americans everywhere, at home and abroad, the production of coal will not be stopped. Tonight, I am speaking to the essential patriotism of the miners and to the patriotism of their wives and children. And I am going to state the true facts of this case as simply and as plainly as I know how. After the attack at Pearl Harbor, the three great labor organizations, the American Federation of Labor, the Congress of Industrial Organizations, and the Railroad Brotherhoods, gave the positive assurance that there would be no strikes as long as the war lasted. And the President of the United Mine Workers of America was a party to that assurance. That pledge was applauded throughout the country. It was a forcible means of telling the world that we Americans, 135 million of us, are united in our determination to fight this total war with our total will and our total power. At the request of employers and of organized labor, including the United Mine Workers, the War Labor Board was set up for settling any disputes which could not be adjusted through collective bargaining. The War Labor Board is a tribunal on which workers and employers and the general public are equally represented. In the present coal crisis, conciliation and mediation were tried unsuccessfully. In accordance with the law, the case was then certified to the War Labor Board, the agency created for this express purpose with the approval of organized labor. The members of the board followed the usual practice, which has proved successful in other disputes. Acting promptly, They undertook to get all the facts of this case from both the miners and the operator. The national officers of the United Mine Workers, however, declined to have anything to do with the fact-finding of the War Labor Board. And the only excuse that they offer is that the War Labor Board is prejudiced. The War Labor Board has been and is ready to give the case a fair and impartial hearing. And I have given my assurance that if any adjustment of wages is made by the board, it will be made retroactive to April 1st. But the national officers of the United Mine Workers refused to participate in the hearing when asked to do so last Monday. On Wednesday of this past week, while the board was proceeding with the case, stoppages began to occur in some mines. On Thursday morning, I telegraphed to the officers of the United Mine Workers asking that the miners continue mining coal on Saturday morning. However, a general strike throughout the industry became effective on Friday night. The responsibility for the crisis that we now face rests squarely on these national officers of the United Mine Workers and not on the government of the United States. But the consequences of this arbitrary action threaten all of us everywhere. At 10 o'clock yesterday morning, Saturday, the government took over the mines. I called upon the miners to return to work for their government. The government needs their services just as surely as it needs the services of our soldiers and sailors and marines, and the services of the millions who are turning out the munitions of war. You miners have sons in the Army and Navy and Marine Corps. You have sons who at this very minute, this split second, may be fighting in New Guinea or in the Aleutian Islands or Guadalcanal or Tunisia or China, or protecting troop ships and supplies against submarines on the high seas. We have already received telegrams from some of our fighting men overseas, and I only wish they could tell you what they think of the stoppage of work in the coal mines. Some of your own sons have come back from the fighting fronts wounded. A number of them, for example, are now here in an army hospital in Washington. Several of them have been decorated by their government. I could tell you of one from Pennsylvania. He was a coal miner before his induction, and his father is a coal miner. He was seriously wounded by Nazi machine gun bullets while he was on a bombing mission over Europe in a flying fortress. Another boy from Kentucky, the son of a coal miner, was wounded when our troops first landed in North Africa 6 months ago. There's another from Illinois. He was a coal miner. His father and two brothers are coal miners. He was seriously wounded in Tunisia while attempting to rescue two comrades whose jeep had been blown up by a Nazi mine. These men do not consider themselves heroes. They'd probably be embarrassed if I mentioned their names over the air. They were wounded in the line of duty. They know how essential it is to the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, and ultimately millions of other young Americans to get the best of arms and equipment into the hands of our fighting forces and get them there quickly. The fathers and mothers of our fighting men, their brothers and sisters and friends, and that includes all of us, are also in the line of duty, the production line. Any failure in production may well result in costly defeat on the field of battle. There can be no one among us, no one faction, powerful enough to interrupt the forward march of our people to victory. You miners have ample reason to know that there are certain basic rights for which this country stands, and that those rights are worth fighting for and worth dying for. That is why you have sent your sons and brothers from every mining town in the nation to join in the great struggle overseas. That is why you have contributed so generously, so willingly, to the purchase of war bonds and to the many funds for the relief of war victims here and in foreign lands. That is why, since this war was started in 1939, you have increased the annual production of coal by almost 200 million tons a year. The toughness of your sons and our armed forces is not surprising. They come of fine, rugged stock. Men who work in the mines are not unaccustomed to hardship. It has been the objective of this government to reduce that hardship, to obtain for miners and for all who do the nation's work a better standard of living. I know only too well that the cost of living is troubling the miners' families and troubling the families of millions of other workers throughout the country as well. A year ago, it became evident to all of us that something had to be done about living costs. Your government determined not to let the cost of living continue to go up, as it did in the First World War. Your government has been determined to maintain stability of both prices and wages, so that a dollar would buy, so far as possible, the same amount of the necessities of life. And by necessities, I mean just that. Not the luxuries, not the fancy goods that we have learned to do without in wartime. So far, we have not been able to keep the prices of some necessities as low as we should have liked to keep them. That is true not only in coal towns, but in many, many other places. Wherever we find that prices of essentials have risen too high, they will be brought down. Wherever we find that price ceilings are being violated, the violators will be punished. Rents have been fixed in most parts of the country. In many cities, they've been cut to below where they were before we entered the war. Clothing prices have generally remained stable. These two items make up more than a third of the total budget of the worker's family. As for food, which today accounts for about another third of the family expenditure on the average, I want to repeat again. Your government will continue to take all necessary measures to eliminate unjustified, avoidable price increases. And we are today taking measures to roll back the prices of meats. This war is going to go on. Coal will be mined, no matter what any individual thinks about it. The operation of our factories, our power plants, our railroads will not be stopped. Our munitions must move to our troops. And so under these circumstances, it is inconceivable that any patriotic miner can choose any course other than going back to work and mining coal. The nation cannot afford violence of any kind at the coal mines or in coal towns. I have placed authority for the resumption of coal mining in the hands of a civilian, the Secretary of the Interior. if it becomes necessary to protect any minor who seeks patriotically to go back and work, then that minor must have, and his family must have, and will have, complete and adequate protection. If it becomes necessary to have troops at the mine mouths or in coal towns for the protection of working miners and their families, those troops will be doing police duty for the sake of the nation as a whole, and particularly for the sake of the fighting men in the Army, the Navy, and the Marines, your sons and mine, who are fighting our common enemies all over the world. I understand the devotion of the coal miners to their union. I know of the sacrifices they have made to build it up. I believe now, as I have all my life, in the rights of workers to join unions and to protect their unions. I want to make it absolutely clear that this government is not going to do anything now to weaken those rights in the coal fields. Every improvement of the conditions of the coal miners of this country has had my hearty support, and I do not mean to desert them now. But I also do not mean to desert my obligations and responsibilities as President of the United States and Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy. The first necessity is the resumption of coal mining. The terms of the old contract will be followed by the Secretary of the Interior. If an adjustment in wages results from a decision of the War Labor Board or from any new agreement between the operators and miners, which is approved by the War Labor Board, that adjustment, as I have said before, will be made retroactive to April 1st. In the message that I delivered to the Congress 4 months ago, I expressed my conviction that the spirit of this nation is good. Since then, I have seen our troops in the Caribbean area, in bases on the coasts of our ally, Brazil, and in North Africa. Recently, I have again seen great numbers of our fellow countrymen, soldiers and civilians, from the Atlantic seaboard to the Mexican border and to the Rocky Mountains. Tonight, in the face of a crisis of serious proportions in the coal industry, I say again that the spirit of this nation is good. I know that the American people will not tolerate any threat offered to their government by anyone. I believe the coal miners will not continue the strike against their government. I believe that the coal miners, as Americans, will not fail to heed the clear call to duty. Like all other good Americans, they will march shoulder to shoulder with our armed forces to victory. Tomorrow, the stars and stripes will fly over the coal mines. And I hope that every miner will be at work under that flag.
That was President Roosevelt's 24th Fireside Chat from Sunday, May 2nd, 1943, entitled On the Coal Crisis. Next week, we will explore FDR's 25th Fireside Chat from Wednesday, July 28th, 1943, titled On the Fall of Mussolini. I'm Rachel Steele, in for Jim Steele, on 94.7 KPIP's Local Voices, A Glance Back.
Thank you. crown of London town was happy as could be. Everything was apple pie so far as he could see. He'd got his wife, he'd got his kids, and things were right as rain, until the God-forsaken Hun got busy once again. Then Mr. Brown of London town had a job to do, meant to see it through, and he did it too. Mr. Brown of London town sent the wife away, sent the kids to play miles and miles away. Things blew up and things blew down, seemed a blinking shame. Blooming fire and flame, blimey, what a game. But who stood up and saved the town when London Bridge was falling down? Mr. Brown of London town, oi, Mr. Brown.
The drum, he was in the class by himself by gum. Poor Johnny One Note died in Aida, indeed a great chance to be brave. He took his one note, how like the north wind brought forth wind that made critics rave. While Birdie turned round in his grave, couldn't hear the flute or the big trombone. Everyone was mute, Johnny stood alone. Cats and dogs stopped yapping, lions in the zoo all were jealous of Johnny's big trill. Thunderclaps stopped clapping, traffic ceased its roar, and they tell us Niagara stood still. He stopped the train whistles, boat whistles, steam whistles, cop whistles, all whistles bowed to his skill. Sing Johnny One Note, sing out with gusto, and just overwhelm all the crowd.
leave your worries, leave them on the doorstep. Life's sweet. Just direct your feet to the sun, sunny side of the street. Hop, bottle, noodles, that bitter path. You know that happy tune is my step. Life's all right if you dig that beat. On the sun, sunny side of the street, used to walk in the shade with my blues on parade. What a drag, old man, getting stuck in the shade. Get hip, don't